It's The Wonky Show. We're reviewing Labour Party conference and what it all meant for higher education, including a big debate on fees and funding, alongside a freshened up skills agenda, plus a new strategy for regulation in Wales. It's all coming up.
But I do recognise that over time, the value of the fee has eroded. It hasn't gone up in a very long time. But the system we've got overall is just the worst of all worlds.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and back from Labour Party conference in Liverpool. As usual, three fantastic guests on campus. It's Pam McPherson-Barrett, Head of Policy and Regulation at the University of Leeds. Pam, your highlight of the week, please.
I think I'm supposed to say it's my kid's birthday, but really it's been back in the office this week and seeing all the freshers coming, and the campus is really coming alive again, and that's just, it's just really great. It's what we're here for, isn't it?
Alive refreshers flu too, probably. A thousand germs bloom. Yeah. In South London, it's Aaron Porter. Various non-executive board and advisor roles should have practiced that. Aaron, how should I bill you here?
I think I'm mainly thinking about being chair of BPP and deputy chair of Goldsmiths. But my highlight of the week does come from Labour Party conference, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit more. But it was seeing a friend of mine, a former colleague, Wes Streeting, give his first speech as health secretary in a Labour government. And we can debate the merits of the conference and the policy, but actually seeing someone who I've worked with and have a huge amount of respect for stand up as a member of the cabinet was really quite a startling moment and a very proud one.
I'm totally with you there. Also, having worked with you and Wes back in the day, he was living his best life in Liverpool this year. I have never seen him so happy. this is all he's ever dreamed of. It was rather sweet. But yeah, it's kind of amazing to see his rise. And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your heart of the week, please.
Morning, Mark. Yeah, I feel I should say something about the Labour conference, but actually we're getting a cat in 2 days' time, so that is going to be the highlight of my week.
Okay, so we start the week in Liverpool for Labour. Michael, tell us what happened.
Yes, so a lot of Team Wonky decamped for Liverpool this week, myself included. We got the sort of general conference joys of sort of pouring rain, terrible coffee, very hot rooms, big queues, all that kind of stuff. And we were, especially interested in following all the, the new Labour ministers around. I was sort of trying to make sure everything relevant that wasn't just sort of fluff was in the daily briefings. There were some interesting things we picked out. Jackie Smith talking to a King's Policy Institute panel. She was pretty clear that there's conversations ongoing with the Treasury about improving student maintenance, which has also been kind of reported separately in the papers recently. She gave a pretty noticeable nod to that. She talked about needing a new international education strategy, and suggested quite strongly Labour is sort of still thinking, what's it going to do with the lifelong learning entitlement? So in terms of policy, that was about as far as it went. There's the wider mood music, which Jonathan Simons has done a very good job unpicking in a blog for us this morning. He sort of says he can see five key focuses, which in what all the ministers are saying, which are going to be the things Labour is interested in, even if we don't know exactly how they're going to move on them. So that's things like widening participation, economic growth, civicness, efficiency, and a better student experience. And even I saw on Twitter this morning, Jackie Smith said, she's been reading Wonky and said what Jonathan's put in his piece is a pretty fair description of her agenda.
Lovely. Yeah. So I recommend everyone read that piece. The Jackie Smith doctrine, the minister herself, as you say, says that there's a fair reading, I think she said, of the situation. And that's, I guess, a good start. Aaron, we weren't expecting any hard policy this week coming out of Labour in Liverpool, but a doctrine for a new minister, that's something, isn't it?
Well, it's a direction of travel. It did feel to me a little like a conference, the one that you might expect actually before a general election rather than 2 months yeah. after it. So it was, still saying, this is the road that we're intending to take, rather than here's how we're going to actually forge it. I think, as you say, there's the kind of Jackie Smith doctrine, which is well worth a read. Taking one step further back, the one thing that did come through powerfully at Labour Party conference was the emergence of these five missions. And I think the way in which government is going to be slightly organised and ordered in a way that we haven't really seen previously provides an interesting and different framing. But clearly, the detail is yet to come, and that's what we're all really interested in.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's obviously a long road, isn't there, Pam, on to go on international students and all of that. But still, you know, more things pointing in the right direction in terms of that the mood over that.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, that was one of the things we were really hoping for before the general election, wasn't it? That at the very least, the mood music would change. But we know that it takes a while for anything like that to flow through into international recruitment, and there's still a lot of barriers in a lot of areas for different countries wanting to come here and study. So I think we've still got a lot more to do in terms of creating a, you know, a welcoming and a supportive environment for the international students. There's been lots of articles on Wonky about we can't just take them and take their money and use it to cross subsidize everything else. We need to be providing a really good education experience for those students who are coming to us as well.
This week, I've been at Labour Party conference finding out what MPs are talking about on Everything Research. Three big things that stand out for me. The first is that mission government is at the heart of everything Labour is going to do, whether that is growing the economy to the highest proportion, the highest sustained growth in the G7, or whether that is just transition, or whether that is tackling deep-trenched social inequality issues. Everything is running through Labour's five big missions. I'm not advocating that universities simply adopt the language of missions, but nonetheless being mindful about how we contribute to these wider social issues is a big opportunity. The second is that in seeing Peter Kyle and Patrick Vallance talk, the culture wars seem over. There is a much warmer tone towards universities and everything that they do. And the third, in a wonderful session held by UCL and SMF, it is clear that there is a growing expectation that universities should be doing all that they can to address social challenges in their areas. Tied in to the wider funding conversations, the more that universities can do to make the case that what they do is good for society, the greater audience they will have when it comes to asking for more public funding.
I think, I mean, I wasn't at the conference, so I've had it all secondhand through the wonderful Wonky Daily briefings, but also other podcasts I listen to. And I think you're right, it's quite light on policy, but there is everybody was obviously very pleased to have won the general election. And there was, you know, there's definitely, I'm getting a sense that they're getting everything ready and they're getting ready to move. What I really hope is that we start seeing that policy that's a bit light on the ground at the moment. And we start seeing, what are you going to be doing on your five missions, and how might we as a sector be able to help support the delivery of that?
And as well as policy detail, Pam, I think the other thing that's really relevant from the conference is tone and the extent to which there's optimism or not about where the country finds itself in. There was a sense that really since the general election, Labour have focused very deeply on outlining quite how problematic the economic position is, and we've seen some of the announcements they've made around that. But it was interesting, over the course of the conference, you could sense that there was a slight change in the need to also offer, there is a direction towards the sunny uplands, and there's a direct interface between the policy that you might need to enforce or implement in order to get there, and that how that impacts on tone and mood as well.
That's true, isn't it? And do you think they're still learning how to be a government, because they've spent so long in opposition? There's not, I mean, I know they brought in people like Jackie Smith, but there's not very much cabinet experience in the government at the moment, is there?
Unquestionably. It does feel like this is a government that is still getting into its groove and finding the right gear. And, you know, being an opposition requires a particular approach, and obviously you're having to critique what the government are doing. Doing that in its place is quite a different way of operating. And I think it's also doubly difficult when you've got very tight fiscal rules in which you're operating in, and therefore you can't suddenly kind of throw money at lots of problems because there isn't the money to throw. So I think it is taking its time, but there is some sense that over the coming months we'll start to get a better feel for what government under Labour will really look like.
That's right. The big question on people's lips, conference was about tuition fees and student finance. And Michael, we did get a few morsels on that, didn't we, this week?
Yeah, we did. So, in terms of ministerial comments on it, obviously, you know, the line is just still, it takes time to get right. And, you know, discussions are ongoing. Modelling, we know, is ongoing. But we did think it was noticeable that, you know, Bridget Phillipson interviewed in the radio was, you know, again, coming back to this question about recent changes to student finance in England being regressive, you know, these changes, which are sort of known as Plan 5, you know, using the regressive word does suggest that they are thinking about making changes to concrete things in how the loan system works around, potentially around interest rates, repayment lengths, all this sort of basket of different things. You know, as Jim has said on the site, if they're not interested in that, why is she trying to hammer home this point about them being regressive? You know, elsewhere on fees, we had Peter Mandelson sort of talking about the need to get them up, and, you know, various other people from within universities making the same point. And Public First's Tim Loinig, the sort of, you know, economist, former government advisor, he was talking at the Fringe, you know, setting out quite ambitious proposals for changes to student finance. And he's also written that up in a report for HEPI, which is just out this morning.
And I think we've got a clip, haven't we, of Bridget Phillipson just talking about this very thing.
The increase in tuition fees. Is that something you'd consider?
I think that's a really unpalatable choice, not least given the very difficult funding system that we have overall. So the system that came in as of last year has become even, you know, more regressive, less progressive, less fair, shall we say, for students who I know are really struggling at the moment with the same cost of living pressures that everyone has faced. So we'll look at all the options. Of course, we will.
Is it off the table entirely, or is it something you would consider in extremis?
It's not something I would want to go to, but I do recognise that over time, the value of the fee has eroded. It hasn't gone up in a very long time. But the system we've got overall is just the worst of all worlds.
So this is fascinating. This is absolutely fascinating because this gets to the heart of what obviously they're thinking about in government and the things we can expect to see. Aaron, the system has become a regressive one, hasn't it? And that was never the intention of the way the fees and loan system was structured in the first place.
Yes, it's a regressive system, and it's one that isn't working for institutions, it isn't really working for students, and frankly, it isn't really working for government. And so on all of those key tests, it really has either had its day and is in desperate need of significant change. I don't think there's any remaining voices really saying, let's stick with what we've got. So of course, the debate now moves on to, well, what can you put in its place? And I have to say, it feels remarkably like Groundhog Day to me. Thinking back to 2010, when there was a new government and most people thinking that the funding system was broken, and a new government with ministers at this stage, a few months in, talking in rather coded terms, critiquing the system that was presently in place, but not really offering a great deal of detail about what they want to do instead, other than saying they'd like something that's more progressive and perhaps striking a different compact between the state, the individual, and institutions.
I think one of the things that was noticeable to me is and often got, you know, loud applause in the room. You probably saw this, Michael, there as well. But there is a feeling that yes, there's a problem with tuition fees that is, you know, well rehearsed on the show, well rehearsed on Wookie, and government ministers know all about that. But there is a major problem with maintenance and you know, essentially the kind of, you know, in the crudest possible terms, you know, the kind of the financial products on offer to students and prospective students and then graduates has become so much more regressive that it's completely thrown out of whack. What everyone that compact Aaron talked about, you know, how much the state should put in, how much university should put in, how much graduates should put in, how much the government should put in, et cetera, et cetera. So do we think that that's where they're going to start? You know, do those two things go hand in hand? Because there's a bit of a narrow window, isn't there, between here and the budget and the spending review, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it feels like this is where they have started. I mean, we do know, as I said, that, you know, there's discussions ongoing between the Department for Education and Treasury about, you know, improvements, you know, medium-term improvements to student finance, probably for the next academic year. But the question is whether they can reach agreement on this for the budget. You know, these arguments will probably continue for another fortnight or so, as the sort of the sums come in, and it could be that they don't. and that thing sort of muddle through for another year until, or at least until the multi-year spending review in the spring. One interesting thing I thought, you know, the reason this came up in conversation at all with Jackie Smith, I mean, she it wasn't part of her speech, it was in the Q&A, and the reason she mentioned student maintenance was in response to a question on WP and on access. And it's clear that they're sort of linking these things together, that, you know, the indebtedness and the cost of participation and the cost of living for the government, they do see this as putting off students from attending university who they would want to, and especially with quite a regional lens on that. I mean, for, you know, obviously WP means many different things, but it was very noticeable being in those rooms that when widening participation is being talked about, it's especially being talked about disparities in entry rates across the English regions.
And on the Lorinig proposals this morning, Pam, I mean, he's made some interesting choices about what the system should look like, right?
Yeah, he has, hasn't he? I think it's like all of these things. You could imagine it could work, but there are a lot of caveats around that. And I would imagine that, for example, an employer levy, which we've talked about off and on for a long time, it's never actually happened. Whether or not you could get that to fly, and whether or not it could be hypothecated in a way that money did actually go towards higher education funding rather than just into the general treasury pot, I think is that's quite a complex question to ask. I think the other thing that stuck out for me was this idea that everybody who graduates would have to pay £10 a week come what may. And I don't know how palatable that would be. So I can see the logic of it, but I don't, in terms of the optics of it, it doesn't feel very palatable that you might ask somebody who has got, you know, two small children in very expensive nursery education and is just working part-time, has to find, you know, 40, 50 quid a month for their student loan repayments. That doesn't feel like it will land particularly well. So I think it's a good debate paper, but I'd be surprised if we ended up with something that was quite like this. I think there's lots of complexities and there's lots of ways that you can pull it apart, which makes it quite difficult. Having said that, I don't have the right answer either.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. I mean, Aaron, you know, you're a veteran of this of the 2010 rows over fees and the settlement that emerged after that as NUS president. Where would you advise NUS now to position itself? So, you know, you famously got in, you know, tremendously political difficulty, didn't you, over this question about fees? When, you know, you, from, you know, if my memory serves me right, you know, trying really hard to lobby for a system that was progressive on repayment and gave students the cash they needed to support themselves at university. But the problem is there's always a trade-off, isn't there? So do you think today's NUS would say, yeah, we'll accept a fee rise if it means institutions are pulled back from the brink of disaster financially, and we get a generous package of maintenance and some of the most regressive elements of the Plan 5 system are rolled back?
There's always a difficult balancing act to strike between being kind of pragmatic, kind of frankly grown up and thoughtful about the thorny issues that lie ahead of you versus the extent to which you might want to focus on issues that are directly relevant to you. So, you know, what I would say to NUS is they need to place equal emphasis on the difficulties around student finance and student maintenance, as well as thinking about the bigger picture in terms of the overall funding for the sector. And in fact, I think if you see those two things in an interconnected way, there is actually an opportunity for NUS to work with Universities UK, Guild HE, the other sort of sector bodies, and try and come up with an overall view for what the sector requires. And that might mean not getting absolutely everything you want for students, but actually it will serve students well if they can get a better package than they've got at present, but the sector is also able to move on to a financially more sustainable footing than it is at present. It works for no one if we've got institutions still fearful that they're going to the wall, staff losing their jobs, and courses being closed. So I think it will require a really healthy dose of pragmatism and navigating some really difficult kind of considerations on all sides.
Yeah. I think one of the other things, just on the sort of tactics of all this, is that I think when we seem to be moving further away from doing another a brand style major review, in, I think, at least in this part of the parliament. So I think what everything is building towards is, you know, medium term tweaks to the system. And I just wonder how long those will stack up, because they'll be controversial in themselves for different reasons. It's very hard to know whether they'll be able to deal with some of the structural longer term issues, or whether it's sort of it's still, we're talking about kind of getting everyone to safety and stabilizing the system and making it fairer.
Well, in a way, the easy and sticking plaster answer is, you know, index rating the tuition fee and doing something similar with student maintenance. But I think that does defer the longer term structural issue that underpins both the system as a whole in England and the general funding system. And I think we need to genuinely return to the point I made earlier, which is the compact, which is, what is the appropriate balance between government, the individual as the graduate, and the other beneficiaries of higher education? And until we really revisit that question, which I think will require serious thought and some genuine outside input to solve it, because I'm not sure the answers will come from within government or tinkering here or there.
I'd agree with that. I think that compact is really important, and we need to stop just talking to ourselves about it. We need to have ways of bringing employers in, but bringing the general public, those who might not directly benefit or obviously benefit from higher education, but will reap the broader benefits of a more prosperous society. And until we can do that, we can't really move this debate forwards very easily.
Yeah, the other thing that kind of really strikes me when I look at these, you know, we get them pretty regularly, big proposals for, here's how I'd like the student finance system to be, and they're quite different from how they are now. Often, you know, say in this, you know, standout change here in Tim Loinig's proposals is changing from the current 40 years repayment in England down to 20. You know, at some point, I really feel there needs to be a bit of a reckoning with the kind of intergenerational, or, you know, perhaps not generational, but sort of longitudinal changes, where we're now getting a situation where different cohorts of students are in really different situations. You know, those on Plan 5, it depends a little bit on, you know, what sector you're going to work in, what your lifetime earnings are going to be. But many people are quite a lot worse off and feel a lot worse off, especially as they get into their 50s and realize they've still got a decade left of repayments. You know, if you suddenly change things so that, you know, people going to university in 2026 were repaying less, repaying for a shorter time, had this sort of eye-catching thing about, you know, interest rates being less, then at some point, surely there needs to be a reckoning with, you know, why is it that going to university in 2024 gets you such a, you know, the raw end of the deal?
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Nicola Campbell, and I work as the Head of Conduct and Respect at the University of York. This week on Wonky, I've been sharing my reflections on the Office for Students' incoming Condition of Registration E6, which will focus on the work that universities do to prevent and respond to sexual misconduct and harassment. The OFS has chosen to define sexual misconduct using criminal language such as rape and sexual assault, and argued that these terms are clearly understood by the public. I'm asking whether this is truly the case, considering that recent research shows us that only half of 18 to 24-year-olds recognise an act as rape if a victim doesn't fight back. I question why there's a complete absence of reference to consent in their definition, despite conversations about consent being one of the things that the sector's generally pretty good at, and highlight existing sector legal guidance that clearly explains why the use of criminal language is not appropriate in a higher education disciplinary context. I'd love to see conversations around the sector to navigate how we work to comply with this new condition, whilst also implementing meaningful, consistent and defensible definitions of sexual misconduct.
Now, there was an announcement on skills at Low Poly Conference. Aaron, talk us through that, please.
Yeah, we said it was a conference that was light on policy announcements, but we did get one, and it was in the Prime Minister's speech, and it was in relation to apprenticeships and changes to the way in which it's going to be funded, the announcement of a new growth and skills levy, which will replace the existing apprenticeship levy. And this will be something that will be overseen by a new body, a new quango, Skills England, which is still kind of getting up and running. But the sense is that it will move to a more flexible flexible approach for apprenticeships, the possibility for shorter apprenticeships, which might engage both learners and also employers in a slightly different way. But there is a feeling and some concern, actually, that it might see a shift away from the quite well-regarded and reasonably well-established level seven apprenticeships towards those at a lower level, which might not actually serve the skills need that we've got in this country as well as we might. So the details yet to come, but we've got a bit of a direction of travel here in relation to this new growth and skills levy.
Yes, this is interesting, isn't it, Michael? And the specific change on the level seven apprenticeships, that is going to take away some of these some of the stuff that goes on in HE at that level, the MBAs, etc. Right?
It is. Yeah. This does, you know, especially for certain universities, and especially for certain universities that have really tried to, you know, keep up with the policy agenda of the day and really, you know, prioritize apprenticeships and degree apprenticeships, which is what, you know, politicians both in the last government, but just, you know, all across the political spectrum have been calling for a long time. You know, they are going to see quite substantial disruptions to their provision in some areas. I mean, as Aaron says, we don't exactly know. If we look at the language the government has sent out, you know, they've sort of talked about, you know, more level seven apprenticeships being paid for by employers, not through the levy. So they didn't say all. We don't have the details, but, you know, it does say that it's going to be Skills England that manages this. And obviously Skills England is very much in its infancy, so we shouldn't expect too much news. You know, reading between the lines, you'd probably think that they'd be looking at perhaps removing certain of the postgraduate degree apprenticeships that have been more controversial, like in subject areas like leadership or finance, which, you know, have seen quite sustained attack over the last few years. You know, but at the same time are very popular, are also seen as generally improving the prestige of apprenticeships. You know, that the there's a benefit to having apprenticeships not just being a sort of thing associated with low skills. You know, these are not just used by sort of people getting MBAs, as it were. It's often people in the public sector. NHS trusts are you know, are big users of this kind of qualification, for example, or local government. So it's potentially quite disruptive to universities, and it's an interesting example of how Skills England, which is going to approve what gets funded and what doesn't, is going to be quite important for HE.
It was mentioned at the beginning, I'm chair of BPP University. Our largest level seven apprenticeship is the solicitor apprenticeship, and it's provided a really important and useful route for teenagers to come into the legal profession, considerably more socially diverse than traditional sort of LLB or kind of more conventional law programs. And so I think there's quite a misunderstanding in the kind of national debate around what really goes on within level seven apprenticeships, and actually how it can and has provided a really useful direct route into employment. So I think, you know, BPP certainly will, and I'm sure there'll be other institutions cautioning Skills England and the government to think very carefully about what the trade-offs might be. I think lots of us want to see more flexibility in the apprenticeship program, certain skill areas at lower levels that have not been adequately supported get that support. But if it comes at the cost of really well-regarded healthcare apprenticeships, legal apprenticeships, those in kind of other sectors which actually have provided a really important route, that would be a real travesty.
I guess whether that happens or not remains to be seen in the detail, but it does signal that sort of moving, reprioritizing this agenda towards young people. And that is interesting and could create potentially other opportunities for universities, Pam.
I think it really could. It's interesting, isn't it, that we're finally starting to look at this in a more holistic fashion. And I don't know how Skills England is going to develop, but the apprenticeship model's maturing in universities and colleges now. And I think this, you know, with a bit of help to remove some of the administrative overhead, we could probably develop a much more innovative model that would really help with the pathway of young people who might not know exactly what it is that they want to do, but they know they want to do something where they can earn at the same time. I think the other thing for me really is actually working more effectively with employers to encourage young people to go through these sorts of routes and be able to find and navigate. And I think we've talked before about it actually getting the opportunities in front of young people at the right point in their lives so that they can take them up. And maybe this refocused work around hopefully aligning with those, you know, Labour's five missions and the skills gaps that we're seeing across the country will help kind of really effectively support younger people in areas that have been economically left behind to kind of really upskill themselves and then again drive that economic recovery, which a lot of the government's investments are going to have to be predicated upon.
Pam, you used the word holistic, and I think that is exactly right. And I think the extent to which thinking in this area genuinely is holistic, I think is certainly up for debate. But it does feed into a report also that was published by Skills England, their very first. As a new body, as Michael mentioned. And at one level, so the report sort of talked about the kind of skills landscape, the skills ecosystem, and it kind of trotted out some, frankly, well-tested and well-rehearsed lines around needing better alignment between higher education and further education, ensuring that there are skills gaps properly dealt with and kind of how the different bits of the jigsaw work together. Well, frankly, you could look at most reports that talk about skills from the Leach Review 20 years ago onwards that talk about these things. The devil is certainly in the detail. And what I haven't really got a sense of as yet is actually how these different bits are going to interface. And that's the difference between having a disjointed approach to skills and one that is genuinely coherent, holistic, and works in the interest of both learners, employers, and the economy as a whole.
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting that the mood at conference, as much as that is sort of really a bellwether for, but the mood at conference was quite negative about Skills England, I thought. I mean, there were a lot of events about skills. Skills are great. We love skills, but in terms of the actual, the existence and of this new body being set up, we had sort of, David Blunkett was moaning it was all taking too long. The West Yorkshire Mayor, Tracy Brabin, who, a Labour mayor, sounded quite unimpressed with this sort of, getting a new body that's sort of based in London, controlled by London. How does this really chime with devolution? You could sort of see a lot of people getting ready to sort of dig their heels in a bit on certain things. And so, I think it's good that they got this first report out, and it is quite a big report, because I think some forward momentum is needed. Hopefully we'll see the bill quite soon. I mean, if it gets much later in the year and they still haven't sort of begun the legislative process, I think we'll have, a new round of people, expressing worries that this sort of too much heel dragging is causing uncertainty. You can see it with this apprenticeships announcement, right? So we don't know what's affected. It may be something very mild, like just employers being asked nicely, essentially, not to do it so much. If you are a university who's thinking about building these links with employers that Pam was mentioning, the fact that there's some uncertainty and potentially an open door for in future other level 7 apprenticeships or even maybe level 6 apprenticeships in certain areas that the government doesn't think is quite so worthwhile, especially in business, that uncertainty breeds a reluctance to really throw yourself into things.
Yeah, Michael, you mentioned devolution there, and that's a really good point, isn't it? Because that's going to be key to realizing that, that skills agenda. And I know that we've still not got full devolution across England yet. So there's something about tying all of these different strands together. And we're all very impatient. We want to get things moving, but some of these things are going to take time, and getting that balancing out between moving with pace so that we can really deliver on some of these real needs across society and getting it right and getting the building blocks in the right place. I think it's going to be a real tension over the next year, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, as you say, some places don't have, regional mayors yet, and others have very established and quite powerful ones that, are respected within the Labour Party. For one thing, they have a power base and also have had control of aspects of the skills system for quite a long time and have plans in place and are not necessarily going to be very receptive to a new public body trying to steer them in other directions. directions.
Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be with City St George's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe. Here's a hidden history of higher education.
How did we end up with a system whereby the government pays for higher education, or used to pay for higher education? One of the key triggers for this is the First World War, where universities are very useful to the state. They help in making munitions, and they help with, you know, textiles work and develop sonar and all sorts of things. But there's a huge meeting organised that happens 12 days after the armistice in 1918, whereby 67 people come in from universities to meet the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the President of the Board of Trade to talk about the next stage of university funding and to make the case for there being proper funding for universities. And they sit there and there are great speeches made and the lovely minutes of these things, of this deputation to the Board of Education by all these university vice chancellors. And they make clear notes. So, for example, Sir Thomas Ackland notes that the government's been spending something like £67 million a day on fighting the war. Surely it could find £2 million a year to support universities. So you've got a mixture of people in the room. So you've still got what are self-declared modern universities. So the principal of the University of Birmingham speaks first, and he decides, you know, he focuses on that professors should be paid more money, and this is important because it also enables the university to throw its doors open to a wider class of the community. And then they talk about how the new PhDs are going to work and how they will develop research work. And he talks happily about not just doubling the university grant, but quadrupling it, because it is supposed to have been doubled in 1915. And then there's a succession of people who talk about the effect that universities have in boosting the nation. And then there's the Vice-Chancellor of the National University of Ireland, Sir Bertram Windle, who sounds like a character from a Terry Pratchett book. But Sir Bertram Windle, he talks about how German education had suffered so badly, and that British education was so much better and worth supporting by the government. They talk about the opportunities that science had done during the war, and they talk about how much science they'd done and how they could fight submarines much better if they, you know, universities were better funded. And then finally, Andrew Bonar Law, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, makes a cautious reply. How unusual, a cautious reply from the man in charge of the money. And he says, well, we'll have a think about this, but we should desire that the university should extend right down to the very bottom of our social system. It's a great access statement there. And then finally joined by H.A.L. Fisher, who's president of the Board of Education, who's been a vice-chancellor himself, and he sets off. And the minutes record the reaction to his little speech at the end. I'm convinced, and my conviction has been deepened by the impressive massive testimony which I've heard today, of the necessity of a very much more liberal assistance from the state to higher learning in the country. Cheers, it says in the notes. And I'm equally convinced from my long connection with universities of the great value of preserving university autonomy. Cheers, it says again. So obviously they were very happy with Fisher's response, and off they go. So we get all the mechanisms that we then run for the next year. We get the University Grants Committee, the Haldane Principle, the funds that come in place. Slowly there's a much more in the way of grants for students, particularly if they're going to do teacher training. And so it comes from that grand meeting with these 67 people, 66 of whom were men, sat in this room saying why universities should be funded by the state.
Now, finally this week, Medawr has a new strategy in Wales. Matt, talk us through it.
Yeah, so this is the culmination, I guess, of that first setup phase of Medawr, and they're consulting on their strategic plan, which is a nice, neat 27 pages. The thing that I really liked about it was that I could actually, as a non-Welsh university person, get a really good sense of what's of what they're trying to do there. It's quite high level. They're regulating the tertiary education sector. That's what you'd expect, but they've got a set of four values, and they have got five strategic aims along with a foundation aim, and they're really setting out, this is how we think we're going to operate. Let's focus on the tertiary education sector as a whole. Let's try and be coherent. Let's ensure that we are, you know, maintaining standards, raising quality of provision. They're bringing research into that in a way that obviously I'm not used to being regulated in England, and also of course, encourage greater use of the Welsh language. So there's a, you know, there's a nice, neat summary on Wonky that David Kernahan did as well. And should you be affected by MEDA, then you've got a few more weeks to respond to the consultation. I think the other thing that I've just pull out is that we're working through, aren't we, all of the different regulators' strategy at the moment. So I had a look, SFC, I've got one that's run through till 2027. The Office for Students runs that next year. So we're expecting to see a consultation from them on their next round of strategy. But for all of them, it's about how they're creating the conditions for a successful sector in their own particular context.
Fascinating to see how different regulatory regimes might emerge across the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we've got this sort of really interesting natural experiment, haven't we, with different regulators in different states of evolution across the UK. And for me, Wales represents a case study of how to do it. The transition from what the minister set out by way of their vision to a body that is finding its feet, but doing so in a way which gives clarity to quite a diverse sector. You know, we're talking about post-16 provision in Wales, which is really quite different in terms of its size and shape and the extent to which it is operating. But you can read the document, as Pam says. You can imagine what's required of the institutions, or what's going to be required of the institutions, how MEDA itself intends to operate. And I think what's also quite reassuring is it is able to say the areas where it has some confidence in the sector, things that it thinks it does well, areas in relation to widening participation, elements of its governance, something I take a particular interest in. But it also sets out some of the areas where it wants to see some improvement. So it sets some sort of foundational expectations, but also what some growth commitments would be, i.e. how things should improve over the 5-year duration of this particular regulator. So I think it sets out a really interesting model for how regulation can be done in a way which still expects improvement, but does it in a cooperative spirit. And I think it's a model that colleagues, whether you're in Wales or outside of Wales, will find really interesting.
Yeah, I guess the question always, in sort of regulation in Wales, is about the time frames. So a lot of this is, intended to some of the things are intended to be in place by August 2026, so just under 2 years away. Other things are even sort of part of a 5-year strategy, as you'd expect, which does mean there's a bit of sort of uncertainty. The whole system of regulation is going to change. There's going to be a new framework for mental health, a new quality framework, and institutions don't quite know what that's going to look like until it's actually there. Things also need to be signed off by the government. So there is always this question about, are things going a bit too slowly? And, I find often when I'm writing about MEDA, there's this question about, okay, ambition is great, having a really clear strategy and sort of plans for consultative, participative work is great. But it's difficult to do that in a time when funding is very tight, when institutions' finances are very tight, and also for Wales against the background of declining participation. I mean, seeing the UCAS data this summer, it was the one UK nation where things were sort of continuing a downward trend. Wales arguably has the worst record on widening participation, and there's lots of institutions in financial difficulties as well. So given those things, how much sort of time and space is there for a kind of good consultative, collaborative process that results in a new regulatory framework in several years' time?
I mean, that is always the dilemma that I think regulators face, on the one hand, setting out a clear vision and wanting speedy action, whilst also trying to take the sector with you. I think it's fair to say that really in the whole creation of the commission up until now, it's erred on the side of taking its time and getting things right, rather than racing to kind of get things set up and into gear, whilst potentially getting things wrong. And I think it stands in an interesting contrast closer to the early years of the Office for Students, where perhaps it really did get things going quite quickly, but possibly didn't get the calibration in terms of how it would execute those conditions of registration, and certainly when we've seen the kind of quality reviews. So in the Welsh context, I personally would rather they take their time and get it right, and I think that's the way in which they've sought to go about doing their business. But you're right, there comes a point at which that taking its time bleeds into uncertainty.
But it is possible, isn't it, to regulate whilst you are developing your strategy. I mean, you know, there's a very clear legislative framework that MEDA's operating in, so that, you know, there is nothing to stop them from continuing their regulatory regime whilst they develop the strategy, and then that will get overlaid in the way that any other organisation who's been in existence a bit longer will refresh their strategy every few years. You can still support and carry out interventions where those are necessary and develop your strategy at the same time. So I would agree with you, Aaron. I would prefer a regulator to take their time to get that high level strategy right and give themselves a strong operating framework, as long as they are able to keep the business running whilst they do so.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in the UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Pam, Aaron and Michael, who also makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.